Diane. On my mind, the spread of divisive concept laws. Last week, New Hampshire passed legislation that blocks the teaching of so-called divisive concepts related to race and gender by public schools, state agencies, and contractors. The Republican-led effort in the Granite State echoes those of GOP lawmakers across the country who claim to be stamping out the proliferation of critical race theory. It's a term the party has thrust into the national conversation and is now taking center stage in arguments at school board meetings and in state houses from coast to coast. Adam Harris is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's been tracking the rise of these divisive concept laws. He joined me to help us understand critical race theory and why it's become a favorite target for the GOP. Adam, give me the lay of the land. How many states have now introduced so-called divisive concept laws, and how many have passed them?
So at this point, there have been 22 states that have introduced these sort of divisive concept bills, and more than a dozen of them have been passed in state legislatures. And this sort of proliferation has really accelerated in recent months, right? If you look back to around March, April, you know, there were maybe 12 states that had introduced such bills. And since then, it's just really grown.
I think there are a lot of people who don't understand what's going on here. Give me some examples of what's being proposed.
So in the case of a state like New Hampshire, they had originally introduced a bill, HB 544, that was banning these divisive concepts. And these divisive concepts, quote unquote, were things like the idea that America is a racist country, the idea that meritocracy is an inherently racist concept. This is sort of legislating speech, saying that certain things taught in schools, certain diversity trainings, are divisive and as such should not be taught.
Give me an example of what should and should not be taught.
It's been interesting because in the legislation itself, they don't say exactly what those things are. They may say you cannot teach that one race is inherently superior to another. You know, other literature with people who are supporting these divisive concept bills, they'll say things like equity is another word for critical race theory, or Black Lives Matter is another kind of catch-all term for critical race theory. And it's sort of all of these general concepts that have received pushbacks in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, as America has sort of done this reconsideration of its history with systemic racism, are now being packaged under this banner of critical race theory, and that's being funneled into these bills that they are labeling divisive concepts.
Before we get to exactly a definition of critical race theory, aren't you surprised, as I am, that New Hampshire, for example, is involved here?
This has been a vein that has sort of encapsulated and kind of captured the imagination of the Republican Party. And as such, it doesn't just kind of lie in states that have traditionally had, more sort of sordid histories with race and racism, and sort of Jim Crow and through segregation, right? This is infecting the entire party. This is something that is pervasive throughout the GOP.
So you're not surprised that New Hampshire is involved here?
No, I don't think so. And I mean, if you look at where sort of the origins of critical race, of the sort of Republican objection to critical race theory, it first kind of gained some national prominence through President Trump effectively banning the teaching of sort of some diversity and equity tactics in federal workforce trainings. And knowing that New Hampshire Republicans supported President Trump as much as they did, I mean, it kind of follows well in line with the Republican Party remaking itself in the image of the former president.
So is the language that's being used in these bills even legal?
A lot of First Amendment lawyers will say that, you know, as written, these bills are not fully constitutional. And when that happens, they're unconstitutional, right? And the original version of this language, as I mentioned, sort of appeared in President Trump's executive order from last September. And a federal judge, within a couple of months, declared that that executive order unconstitutional, or said that it ran afoul of the law. And so a lot of these bills, as they're written, would in the same way run afoul of those laws.
Let's take a step back and talk about what critical race theory actually is. And when it emerged, a lot of people are using that phrase. I'm not sure even I understand it.
So critical race theory kind of grew out of a movement in the 70s and 80s by legal scholars, most notably Derrick Bell, Kimberly Crenshaw, and others, who wanted to kind of understand the ways that race and American law intersect. So critical race theory, more than anything, is a framework for analyzing America's legal infrastructure. It first kind of jumped into national prominence and kind of leapt outside of the academy in the early 90s when President Bill Clinton had nominated Lonnie Guinier to serve in the Justice Department. And a lot of media and conservatives tagged her as a quota queen for her previous work on voting rights. And they said that she sort of trafficked in this radical theory known as critical race theory. Ultimately, even President Clinton kind of says that, you know, I can't support this candidate, and he sort of moves away from her. Her nomination is ultimately revoked. And from there, it sort of goes dormant for a long time. You don't really hear or see critical race theory in any national press. There's a mention around kind of President Obama when a video resurfaces of him giving a hug to Derrick Bell in the early 90s, or in 1990 itself, I should say. But then it really goes dormant until you see in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, the sort of proliferation of anti-racist reading materials, kind of reading guides for people to understand systemic racism. And then you start to see a pushback to that reassessment of American history. And that's when Fox News really starts to.
Okay, but what does critical race theory actually argue?
Critical race theory effectively argues that, you know, kind of what is in the past is not left there. It doesn't argue. It helps kind of understand that what is left in the past did not stay there. So slavery, segregation, Jim Crow, those things continue to have an impact on American society because they are sort of embedded into the legal structures. It's not to say that those issues are intractable, but it's to say that those issues are deeply rooted. And until you sort of get to the root of an issue, you can't necessarily fix it. And so critical race theory is really trying to understand those roots and how they have kind of continued in our legal infrastructure over time.
So it's not a matter of individual bigotry, but it's sort of built into the society.
Yes. Yeah. It's not necessarily trying to, you know, point to individuals and say, oh, you know, because you're white, you're a racist. It's saying that there are systemic factors that are embedded into the legal infrastructure. And not necessarily looking at any individual one of those factors, but really trying to use that framework, that kind of critical lens to understand and evaluate the different structures in American society.
Does that include equity of all sorts?
I think in some ways it does. So look at programs such as affirmative action. A critical race theorist might actually take issue with affirmative action because if you look at critical race theory, it would say that affirmative action is sort of a sort of balm that you sort of rub on top, but it actually is not a salve for the issue, right? When in fact, you know, if you look at the structures and the roots of American higher education, the systemic racism in higher education is actually more deeply rooted than just something you can paint over with affirmative action. Or if you look at housing policy and say that redlining was an issue in the 1930s, 1940s, federal redlining, and then kind of fast forward that to now and look at neighborhoods where 80% of the most highly segregated neighborhoods are neighborhoods that were formerly redlined, and those, that kind of redlining was upheld by different zoning regulations, right? It's sort of looking at how deep the sort of systemic issues go, and then kind of moving forward to, okay, how do you address that? But it first takes that sort of critical lens, critical approach to understanding how kind of deeply rooted those issues are.
And what about our prison system? Where does that fall into critical race theory?
I think that you can also, you know, apply that sort of same critical lens to the prison infrastructure, seeing kind of where kind of the roots of mass incarceration took off. You know, if you look at the explosion of it and after, you know, the 1994 crime bill, if you look even further back than that, it's kind of digging and digging until you can kind of get to that base of, okay, how was that initial infrastructure sort of flawed? And then how do you move forward to sort of break down that infrastructure, right? And I think that a part of the broader conversation here is that, you know, there's in this sort of reassessment of American history, the pushback has been, you know, well, are you saying that all of the founders are racist? And you know, these are people who held two ideals, right? They were holding on to these lofty Enlightenment ideals of all men are created equal, while many of them were holding people in bondage. And so what the sort of national reassessment has been is you can't look at these figures monolithically. You have to look at them as whole people. And if you're putting them on a pedestal and looking at them monolithically and saying that, oh, well, how could they have been bad people if they wrote the Declaration of Independence, they wrote the Constitution. It's saying these people also held people in bondage. And we cannot have a tidy assessment of American history to say that, hey, the Declaration was signed and then the Civil War happened, but then, you know, things started to get better. The 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. And then some other stuff happened. And then the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was signed. And it's like, if you take that kind of cherry-picked American history, it's impossible to sort of live up to those founding ideals of making this a more perfect union if you don't understand what the union is as a whole.
And where is critical race theory currently being taught? At what levels?
So it's primarily still being taught in law schools. And I mean, even some legal scholars have not, even some people who have gone through law school, some lawyers, you know, still don't learn critical race theory, right? It's interesting because there's this thought that it's sort of infected American society writ large, when really it is still a pretty narrow legal field. And one of the most prominent people who has sort of led to the outgrowth of criticism of critical race theory has actually said that it's not necessarily that he's attacking critical race theory as critical race theory actually stands, as it is a academic framework. It's more so to say that anytime someone sees a headline, they can kind of associate the sort of ills that they don't like as critical race theory. So the attacks aren't actually on critical race theory, but they're on this sort of straw man that's cast up as critical race theory, and it's kind of easily being beaten down.
But isn't it also being taught in grammar schools, even to younger people?
Oh, so it's not, and I think it's interesting because over the last couple of weeks, you've seen teachers, you've seen superintendents, principals saying, you know, we don't teach critical race theory in our schools, in part because it's because critical race theory is a framework. And conservatives have criticized over the last couple of days, since the president of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, and the NEA have both come out to say that we will defend teachers from sort of frivolous lawsuits for trying to teach the truth in schools, which is in some ways just sort of American history, right? The way that some of these bills are written may have a chilling effect on teachers who are trying to teach things like redlining, who are trying to teach things like school segregation. We've already seen instances of there was a teacher in Tennessee who was recently fired for teaching an essay by my former colleague Ta-Nehisi Coates, and also showing a video of a spoken word poem. In Florida, there was a teacher who was removed from a classroom at Robert E. Lee High School for having a Black Lives Matter sign flag in her classroom, and so there are these ways that the bills as they are written will have already had sort of a chilling effect on speech. But also, I mean, more broadly, as people have sort of argued about this kind of ongoing culture war, this has sort of become the central peg in the culture war.
So for the most part, I gather it is Republicans who don't want this kind of critical race theory taught to students. They want those students to continue to believe that the country is non-racist, that there is no racial bias, that there is, well, that there was a long, long time ago redlining, but none of that exists anymore. None of the faults of our forefathers should be taught. I mean, is that what you're telling me?
A lot of conservatives have recently argued that kind of to teach students, well, effectively, it's arguing that teachers are teaching students that something that they're not teaching students, for one. And then it's also arguing that, you know, I've talked to parents who have, you know, been active in protesting. They say, well, we want our students to learn math. We want them to learn reading, writing, and arithmetic. And that's what they should be teaching in schools. It's always interesting how often history is left out of that equation. Just thinking broadly, the way that critical race theory has been described is and has been criticized, they say the way that this manifests itself is often in the diversity trainings that happen and things like that. And there are even, you know, critical race theorists and kind of really progressive people who would argue that diversity trainings don't do all that they could, that diversity trainings are often done in a haphazard manner. There have been a proliferation of kind of diversity training since the murder of George Floyd and companies trying to understand what their roles are in this kind of broader systemic racism. One example that I've been pointing to is as one of the progressive critiques of it is, so a lot of banks held diversity trainings. They hired people into their C-suites as diversity executives. But, you know, after the Biden administration announces, okay, that we'll have $4 billion for Black farmers for historical kind of systemic racism that they faced from banks and from the federal government, the banks sent a letter to the federal government saying, if you do this debt relief, we will lose money, effectively arguing for the government to slow the pace of the relief for the Black farmers. And so the progressive critique might be that, well, if you actually cared about kind of your role in systemic racism, and if the diversity training actually worked, the diversity, equity, inclusion training worked, that letter is never sent because you understand that you played a critical role in the discrimination against these farmers.
More of my conversation with Adam Harris when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Adam Harris. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the forthcoming book, The State Must Provide, Why America's Colleges Have Always Been Unequal and How to Set Them Right. You know, I'm reminded, and I wonder about your thoughts on this, after the Second World War, Japan edited all of its teaching to young people about what really happened in the Second World War and its own role in the Second World War. But it's as though a sector of our society wants to wipe out the faults of our history and somehow pretend that none of it ever happened.
In some ways, that project has been an ongoing one, right? If you even look back to The Lost Cause, it's sort of trying to rewrite the narrative of what actually happened in history. And I mean, if you look across textbooks, even as recent as a few years ago, right, they will teach that, you know, Africans were better off coming over to the U.S. I recently remember a textbook that said they brought over immigrant labor from Africa. When it sort of whitewashes the history of what slavery was and the brutality of chattel slavery, right? That in some cases, women were bred to have offspring so that there was more, so that they would have more slave labor in the South, you know, and how vital that was to the economy. And there's also this the argument that, oh, all of that is in the past. All of this is so long ago. Slavery happened 150, 170 years ago. But if you think about school segregation, it's 1962 that Ole Miss is effectively burning. It's 1950, it's the mid-1950s when Brown v. Board of Education goes into effect. I did a series last year with the students, a lot of the first Black students to attend the white schools in their town. And one that really sticks with me is the story of Joanne Allen Boyce, who was one of the first students, one of the first 12 students to integrate public schools in Clinton, Tennessee in 1956. And it's literally 5 months after they integrated the schools, 4 months after they integrated the schools, someone bombed Clinton High School. No one was in the school at the time, but they literally reduced the school to rubble. And so to think that I could sit in her living room and have this conversation with her about this experience that she had, about the experience I sat in a P.F. Chang's with Sunny Hersford the third, or Sunny Hersford the fourth, sorry. And he integrated public schools in Alabama in the 1960s. And he's younger than my parents. And so, you know, just thinking about that, and that this is not some far off, very distant past, that this is incredibly recent, and that people don't want to teach that history because they think it might be divisive, is a really jarring thing to think about, taken in concert with each other.
So now to today, tell us about Christopher Rufo, who lives in Seattle. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so Christopher Rufo is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank. And he, last year, he received a tip from a municipal employee in Seattle that said that the city was conducting these quote unquote internalized racial superiority seminars. And that in so doing this diversity training that he should sort of check it out because he would not like what was going on in Seattle's municipal, the city government. And so he files a FOIA request, receives documents and publishes his first piece in the City Journal, which is the Manhattan Institute's public policy magazine. Over the next couple of months, he receives other tips from different places across the country that are effectively saying that they're also being subjected to diversity seminars, you know, places everywhere from kind of the Treasury to the military. And by September, he goes on Tucker Carlson's program. This is early September, and he effectively tells viewers that critical race theory, which he has started calling it at this point, has become the domineering ideology of the federal bureaucracy, and it is infecting every wing of the federal government. And he calls on President Trump to effectively ban what he is describing as critical race theory, right? This idea that it's teaching white people to hate themselves, it's teaching Americans to hate America. And the president was watching the broadcast, and his chief of staff reaches out to Rufo the next day, and 3 weeks later, the president signs an executive order banning exactly what Rufo had described as critical race theory and federal workforce trainings.
And is he still talking that way?
Since then, he has advised several state legislatures who have crafted their own quote-unquote divisive concept bills. He is, you know, given testimony during hearings and has really been sort of the public face of the sort of anti-critical race theory movement. And it was interesting, a couple of months ago, he tweeted what effectively the strategy is, right? And he says that the goal is to get everyone, when they see a headline, to associate critical race theory with all of the things that they don't like. So whether that is this push for equity, whether that is Black Lives Matter, whether that is this sort of general kind of assessment, deep assessment of American history, to associate all of that with critical race theory and really sort of using it as a cudgel in the culture war.
So you've got critical race theory, according to Senator Ted Cruz, says that every white person is a racist. And that's what to supporters of Trump and those who believe what he has said, that's what they understand critical race theory to be.
That is what they understand critical race theory to be. And when we did some polling back in May, most Americans were unsure if they had heard of critical race theory and were unwilling to define critical race theory or weren't sure if they had heard of it. And more recent polling has suggested that more Americans, more conservatives, are willing to say that they know what, not only do they know what critical race theory is, but that they agree that state legislatures should ban critical race theory in schools. And it's also in talking to, you know, anti-kind of critical race theory parents, people who are showing up at school boards and protesting, they will say that, you know, when you tell them, well, critical race theory was a academic framework founded in the 1970s and 80s to understand the ways that race and American law intersect, they will say that's the semantic argument, because what's really happening is what they're hearing on a regular basis on Fox News. And we're in a moment where a large swath of the population is unwilling to kind of listen to what is being said outside of the Fox News infrastructure. And if your primary information source is telling you, you can't believe what they're telling you about critical race theory, because this is what's actually happening about critical race theory, and anyone who is saying the opposite is lying to you, then it's very difficult to break through that echo chamber.
So you've written that it's the vagueness of this definition that really troubles you. How can that be corrected? How can that be improved? How can that be changed so that it's not a falsehood that's being put out there?
It's difficult, in part because, you know, these lawmakers will continue to introduce these bills. It's difficult to know how that can be corrected. But I think the clearest thing is that this isn't an issue that is going away. This has become a central, kind of one of the central battlefields in the sort of broader culture war. And, you know, Republicans have really leaned into identifying the things that they don't like as critical race theory. And so it's now difficult to do that work of divorcing those two terms and saying that, no, what you are upset with actually is not critical race theory, because it has become so pervasive in sort of the national lexicon at this point.
And the school boards themselves are having to face questions from parents, and how are they responding?
So the school boards have, you know, several points said that, you know, this is not happening in our schools. You know, we are not teaching critical race theory, and parents, they don't believe it. They think that, you know, it's a part of this larger scheme to sort of lie to them about what is going on in schools. And you've already seen at some points in different parts of the country, where, you know, school board members are resigning. They're receiving these sort of large FOIA requests, where they're effectively told to sort of survey most of their teaching staff and their curriculums to ensure that the, you know, critical race theory is not being taught.
But shouldn't it be taught?
You know, I think that American history in its full breadth should be taught in schools. And critical race theory as a framework, as something that is taught regularly in law schools, as a way to kind of help lawyers understand the ways that the law is written, that was sort of the original purpose of critical race theory. But I think what teachers argue that they are doing, and they you know, time and time again, now that they're having to fulfill these FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, I should say, they argue that we are teaching American history. And on top of that, there's not enough time in a school year, right, to go as in-depth on these topics as a lot of people are assuming that teachers are doing. Students may spend a week on an era, and then they're moving on to the next topic. So it's like both the issue of what is being taught in schools has been, one, overblown, but then it's also, in a lot of ways, teachers would argue, a sort of bad faith attack on what they are doing as a profession, and sort of the latest iteration of trying to handhold teaching as a profession rather than, you know, allowing these professionals who went to school, who learned how to do what they're doing, to teach and to educate students.
So why do you think it is that in this current moment, Republicans are going after this as hard as they are?
You know, there is the question of, you know, maybe it is to energize the base. This became at the tail end of former President Trump's administration, this became one of his central planks. He was regularly arguing, kind of railing against critical race theory. And so in some ways, it's sort of a continuation of that. And, you know, one of the ways to build a bench, to energize a base, is to get people involved at a local level. And one of the things that this sort of anti-critical race theory fight is doing is getting Republicans involved at the local school board level. It is getting them involved in the local kind of county level. And, you know, I think for Republican politicians, they see in that kind of hope for a sustainable future for the party, but in a kind of more racially diverse society, in a country that is growing more diverse by the year, kind of long-term, whether that's a sustainable strategy has yet to be seen.
And the New York Times 1619 Project sure took a hit, as well as the people who worked on that.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of the 1619 Project. It's CRT. In Texas, they actually introduced the 1836 Project, which is looking at the Texas's founding itself. And people have already poked holes in that to say that, well, if you actually want to look at Texas's founding, you should think about kind of Texas's role in slavery. You should think about who was allowed to be a citizen in Texas at the time,
and the Alamo, over the Alamo.
Exactly. So there are all of these separate kind of proxy battles going on right now, but they are all kind of going back to this central idea of people are taking a second look at American history, at the breadth of American history, because if you are interested in the project of improving the nation, of making it a more perfect union, then you do have to take those critical kind of hard looks at what is going on, or what has happened, and how that can be addressed.
So, Adam, we've talked a lot about what Republicans are doing. How are Democrats reacting to all of this and this push against the teaching of critical race theory?
You know, Democrats have largely responded by saying that, you know, this is that teachers are simply teaching American history, and that critical race theory isn't being taught in schools, and that this is a sort of that it's sort of a straw man attack to say that they're teaching critical race theory in schools. You know, as for kind of anything legislative or forceful, there hasn't been any sort of legislative response from Democrats, but largely it has been trying to, in some ways, kind of correct the narrative that this is going on in public schools, and to say that, as a broader assessment of American history goes, that the works that are coming out now that are really kind of delving deeply into American history and trying to understand the roots of systemic racism are important, and that kind of having greater knowledge of your country is maybe at its root one of the most patriotic things you can do. To know more about your country is actually the role of a good citizen. Actually, if you go back to what the founders thought education could be, right, with Benjamin Rush and George Washington and James Madison, they had this idea of a national university, of places where people could learn the arts and sciences and history, but they could also learn how to be good citizens. And if education is supposed to teach you how to be a good citizen, one of the best ways you can be a good citizen is to know the history of your country.
So what do you think the end game here is for the GOP? Is this pushing of an argument over critical race theory? Is it working for them?
As far as, you know, convincing more people that what they are upset with is critical race theory, it has been relatively effective over the last several months. But again, it's the question of in the long term, is this something that is it a sort of sustainable anger that they're ginning up as the base is sort of being activated, is kind of stoking that sort of resentment something that can continue in a growing kind of racially diverse democracy. But I mean, of course, at the same time, you are also seeing a proliferation of voting restrictions going into place in different states. And so it's really, there's been a reactionary tinge over the last year. And I don't see that dissipating anytime soon.
You know, it's so interesting. I graduated high school in 1954, the year of Brown v. Board of Education. So there were no Black students in our high school. I recall that so vividly now as I watch a film and read a book like The Underground Railroad, and see for myself what the history of racism is and has been in this country. The ways in which land was taken from African Americans after they had built up their own way of making a living and then having it all stolen. Shouldn't kids know about that? I'm old now, and these kids, if they don't learn about this as young people, they will continue to believe in white superiority, and that white superiority is, from the beginning, always has been, always should be, the state of our nation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, teaching students, you know, the depth of American history, teaching them about segregation, teaching them about, teaching them about Jim Crow, teaching them about slavery, I think that is important to understanding what America has been. I mean, you know, people regularly talk about Martin Luther King, but the part that is not discussed is people hated Martin Luther King when he was alive. A lot of white people did not like Martin Luther King. The public was not on Martin Luther King's side. It was only after he was assassinated and several years had gone by that people sort of rallied around this idea of Martin Luther King. And so it has never been in vogue to challenge the sort of power structure of the nation and sort of try to understand the depths of the nation. I mean, Martin Luther King talked about America's promise to Black Americans as a check that is void, insufficient funds. And so to understand him, to understand the sort of broader swath of American history, you do have to learn the ways in which that check came back insufficient fund, the persistence of discrimination in several in several fields, whether that's legal, whether that's medical, whether that is in health outcomes, whether that is in educational outcomes, whether that is in the criminal justice system, whether that's in housing, right? If you're looking at this sort of broad swath of inequality in America, I think that it is important to understand that history and how that history continues to influence our present.
Are you at all optimistic?
I am optimistic, in part because one of the things that we have seen over the last several weeks is teachers sort of reasserting that their job is to teach students the truth. Their job is to educate students what they have been taught to do. And I think that seeing that resilience of educators as they are kind of facing this sort of onslaught of criticism has been interesting to see.
And as a Black man with young children, are you optimistic for yourself in your lifetime and for them in theirs?
You know, I think back to my grandfather and him always saying that he was working to have, you know, make a better life for his children. So my mom and my grandma saying that she wanted a better life for her children. So my dad and her, his brothers and sisters, and my parents saying the same for me. And so you always kind of have to have that hope, and knowing that, you know, throughout history, and our ancestors have had a sort of resilience and have fought back against so much. And so knowing that and knowing that sort of kind of come from that lineage, that is kind of the thing that actually gives me the most hope. Knowing where America has been and where America can go with people who are willing to actually live up to that ideal of fighting for a more perfect union.
Adam, thank you for your work on this issue. I hope you continue to write about it. And thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Adam Harris, staff writer at The Atlantic. He is author of the forthcoming book, The State Must Provide, Why America's Colleges Have Always Been Unequal and How to Set Them Right. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Steve Lack. Thanks for listening. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.